Welcome everyone around the world to It's a Wrap with Rap. I am your host, Ron Rappaport. Would like to thank all of our listeners, viewers, supporters, and sponsors for helping to make this podcast such a success. We are being heard and viewed in all 50 states, all provinces of Canada, and over 70 countries around the world. Please visit the podcast website, itsawrapwithrap.com, for all the episodes and to order podcast logo merchandise and other fine products from our sponsors to support the podcast. This podcast features people who have overcome life's challenges, people who can inspire, motivate, and educate us on an assortment of topics. My guest today, who has been a prior guest, is Dr. Susan Partovi from Los Angeles, California. In high school, she traveled to Tijuana, Mexico with a church group to build houses over spring break and met an early mentor who introduced her to poverty medicine. During college, she continued to travel to Mexico, and those experiences built a foundation for working with the underserved and solidified her desire to pursue a career in medicine. After earning her medical degree and completing her residency in family medicine, she was surrounded by like-minded colleagues with a passion for working with the homeless, the poor, and the uninsured. Over the years, Dr. Partovi has treated patients at several community clinics, and in 2006 became the medical director at Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles. At Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles, she started practicing street medicine in the Skid Row neighborhood of Los Angeles, which brings medical care and treatment to the streets to serve the homeless. Los Angeles has the highest number of what we call people experiencing homelessness in the United States, and the Skid Row area contains the highest concentration of homeless people. Recognized internationally as a leader in homeless and street medicine, Dr. Partovi is often asked to speak to undergraduates, medical students and residents, and to county health departments, hospitals, and conferences about ministering to the homeless and impoverished. In 2009, Dr. Partovi traveled to Haiti with UCLA medical students as part of a project on poverty medicine. Along with her friend, Dr. Elaine Goldhammer, they founded HEAL, HEAL, Healthcare Empowerment Advocacy and Learning, a nonprofit that brings supplies and medical students to clinics in Haiti. She is here today to discuss her new book, Renegade Doctor, A Doctor's Stories from the Streets, and to hopefully make us and our communities begin to recognize the shared humanity of our most vulnerable. Welcome, Dr. Partovi, to the podcast.
Hi, thank you. That was a great intro.
Yeah.
But the book, it's actually called Renegade MD.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say?
You said Renegade.
Oh, I said Renegade Doctor. All right. I'm sorry. Renegade MD. Yeah, let's get that straight right from the get-go. It's Renegade MD, A Doctor's Stories from the Streets.
Yeah.
Now, in 2007, you started practicing street medicine. What made up your mind to treat the impoverished?
So, like you said, in my early years, college years, I was going to Mexico or Tijuana, which is not very far from Los Angeles, on the weekends with a church group and my mentor, Steve Knopf at the time. And he was a physician assistant and he was going to deliver care. And I just really felt at home with that kind of community, taking care of that community, and realizing that I wasn't a doctor then. And so realizing that it wasn't about how much knowledge you had about medical care, but the actual care part was the important part. So I really wanted to make sure that I was going every weekend so that they would see that I was committed to them. And I learned Spanish, I learned medical care, you know, learned a little bit about diabetes, you know, as the years went on, and learned how to talk to patients. And then just really felt at home being that extra kind of wraparound person for someone who's just in so much need.
Yeah.
And fast forward, started working at the Venice Family Clinic in 2003. and got introduced to homeless medicine through their programs there. And we went to the National Healthcare for the Homeless Conference, where we saw a presentation on street medicine by Dr. Jim Withers, who's kind of like the father of street medicine in the U.S. And so, you know, the medical director and I were both at the conference and at that workshop, and I just kind of look at her and I'm like, I want to do this. And she's like, okay. So we just, you know, we teamed up with a team that was already doing outreach, not necessarily medical. And it was a whole different ball game, a whole different ball game, because these are people who can't make it to the shelters for whatever reason, can't make it to the clinic for whatever reason. And we're going, you know, under the pier and on the promenade and places where they hang out, and going to them and seeking them out and building a relationship with them so that they can trust us, using anything as an engagement tool, like socks or hats or water, you know. And and then with time they learn to trust you, and you know, eventually we try to woo them into care and to accepting resources. And nowadays the goal is housing.
So you kind of answered my next question, which is, what is the purpose of street medicine?
So I did kind of answer it. So we realized that a lot of people experiencing homelessness, for whatever reason, don't want to go to the clinic, don't go to shelters, don't go to the normal places where the clinicians would be. And so we started realizing, we meaning the community of people who do homeless medicine, we just really see the importance of going out to them. And because their lifestyle is to a point where, you know, they can't make it to a clinic. They can't even, you know, secure their own. If you really want to be reaching the sickest of the sick, then that's what you need to do. You need to go where they're at. And there's a lot of hoops that normally we can jump through that they can't jump through. And so we're really trying to make things as easy for them as possible. So we come with we don't say, oh, well, go to the clinic and get your blood pressure checked. You know, we check their blood pressure.
Right.
Or we give them the medications right there and then. Or nowadays, most of them have Medi-Cal. So we'll put the prescription into the pharmacy. We'll go pick it up ourselves and bring it back to them. So you're really going out of your way to make things work for them, because they're just not at a place where they can do that for themselves. And so me personally, I'm seeking out the sickest of the sick. And when I say that, I mean to the point where they can't even take care of themselves, which is why I've started focusing more on people who are severely mentally ill, because in my opinion, those are the ones that are really, really, really disabled, really at risk of morbidity and mortality. And so I'm just trying to
feel as good as you can. Yeah. I think it's wonderful that there's people out there like you leading the charge, because I can imagine most doctors probably wouldn't want to do that kind of work. I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely becoming a little bit more popular, but yeah, most people don't want to be dealing with this population.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Doctors included, but, or clinician, you know, not just doctors are out there, nurse practitioners, RNs, PAs. So you've got
sure.
the full of caretakers out there, but it is a special group of people who are committed to working with that population.
Very
so,
special, very special group. You know, I read the book, Renegade MD, and it's a great book. I recommend it for everybody. I believe it's going to be out in the end of January, 2024. Is that correct?
January 30th is the publisher's date.
Okay. Now, in the book, you gave a definition of a good doctor. What describe the idea? What is, in your opinion, a good doctor?
That's a really good question. And throughout the book, when I talk about a good doctor versus a shitty doctor, hope I can say that.
Yeah, you can say that.
It's not just a doctor. It could be, you know, a person, really. It could be anything in what you do. So
yeah.
It doesn't pertain to the medical field, but it's kind of synonymous with Renegade MD. And in fact, the original name of the book was A Good Doctor. What I see as a good doctor is someone who thinks ahead and says and thinks about all the steps it's going to take to get this person to a healthier state. And you're looking at the holistic picture of this person. Like, if I prescribe them an antibiotic and I send it to the pharmacy, are they going to be able to go to the pharmacy? So I have to think, okay, I don't think this person's going to be able to go to the pharmacy. I'm going to provide the medicine for them and hand it to them so that they take it. So it's really having that gestalt look at their life and trying to jump as many hoops for them. So you're really going that extra mile. You're doing whatever it takes to keep them healthy and safe and alive. And so that's part of being a renegade doctor or a good doctor, but then also being compassionate, being caring, but being accepting. So that's I think the caveat that a lot of other clinicians might have a hard time with, because there's stigma and there's we think of someone who's a substance user, you know, the term that we use is drug addict, and we immediately think, you know, horrible person, you know, selfish, doesn't care about anyone else but themselves. When really, in my experience, I would say most people's substance use is due to trauma, that they have very significant trauma in their past, and this is how they deal with it. And so instead of coming with judgment, maybe come from an angle of compassion and accepting what works for them and what doesn't. Even if I think they should be doing X, I need to listen to them and see what they want in their life.
Yeah.
And so they want to keep using. So then I need to be in a place where I'm not vilifying them for using substances or drugs, and that I'm helping them. What's the first thing that I want to make sure? Don't die. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's my hierarchy of needs for my patients, right? So first, don't die. Second, get off the streets. Third, start living your life, right?
Right.
So if they're using, especially if they're using fentanyl and they want to keep using fentanyl, if I start vilifying them for their choice in the moment, they're not going to come back and see me, because I'm going to be the evil one that's telling them that they're not doing the right thing. So instead, you accept them where they're at. You try to give them as much healthy choices as possible. So for example, make sure if you're going to use fentanyl, don't use by yourself. Use with a buddy. Make sure that buddy has Narcan, which is the overdose reversal medicine.
Right.
Or use in a space so that someone can call 911. Or use in front of the needle exchange, because, you know, they do overdose reversals there. You know, make some wise decisions, which sounds counterintuitive, right? But
right.
you can talk, if you talk to people like that with as it's almost like, oh wow, they get me. They're treating me with respect.
Right.
And so they come back, and they when if they ever are ready to get help with their substance use or their mental illness or whatever's kind of keeping them down and out, then they feel comfortable coming to us.
You also had in the book your idea of, quote, we over me and we not them, we and not them. Well, what did you mean by that?
So I think when it comes to taking care of people, especially who are severely mentally ill,
Yeah.
my opinion, there is a very loud voice group who says, we don't want to take people's civil liberties away from them. And I think that that loud voice has become an excuse for us not to put in the resources for really taking care of those who can't take care of themselves. And so for example, if someone has dementia, I had to deal with my mother who had severe dementia and my sister who had dementia, right? And if they need to be hospitalized and you tell them, oh, they have dementia, and it's easier if an older person and they have, and even if the patient is, fighting, no, I don't want to be hospitalized, the hospital will hospitalize them because they realize that someone with dementia can't make decisions for themselves. But when it comes to people who are severely mentally ill, it's like, oh, well, they're adults. They're allowed to make decisions for themselves. And so I think we've used that as an excuse to not go that extra mile and take care of them the way they should be taken care of. And so when financial incentives become a reason for not taking care of someone, that's a us versus them philosophy, in my opinion.
Got it. Got it. Now, can you explain to us the impact of the 1967 state laws adopting to protect the right to refuse psychiatric treatment and the stringent, I believe it's the Lanterman-Petras Short or the LPS Act that called for an end of involuntary commitment of people with mental health disorders and does it contain a community follow-up provision? What was the impact of that?
So they weren't necessarily wrong in creating that, in that people were being hospitalized against their will for things that, we've all seen the movies of, people who are very capable of taking care of themselves being quote unquote thrown into the hospital against their will. So there definitely needed to be some standardization around that. However, so California was one of the first states to have a law that defines what grave disability is, and what the reasons are for hospitalizing someone against their will. So, danger to self or others, and inability to care for one's clothing, food, or shelter. So that's a
Let me break away for a very important message that may pertain to many listening to this podcast. Did you know that you can sell your life insurance for immediate cash? 85% of people have no idea this is even possible. Also, did you know that 92% of life insurance policies never pay a death claim? A life insurance policy is considered an asset that you own, meaning you, the policy owner, can sell it for a lump sum cash payment known as a viatical settlement, which is tax-free and non-regulated, meaning you decide how the money is spent. A viatical settlement pertains to people living with a serious or chronic illness, such as cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, or AIDS, with no age restriction. For others who do not qualify for a viatical settlement, a life settlement may be an option if you qualify to relieve the burden of having a policy you may no longer need or serves the original purpose it was purchased for. Studies show that 42% of new cancer patients deplete their life savings during the first 2 years of treatment. Cancer patients are twice as likely to declare bankruptcy as those without the disease. Life Insurance Buyers Incorporated, based in Kansas City, Missouri, owned and operated by husband and wife team Greg and Lisa Albers, are licensed viatical and life settlement brokers that act as a fiduciary to protect the best interests of you, the policy owner, in the life settlement process by creating a competitive auction with licensed buyers to deliver the best possible value to you, the seller of your policy. Greg has been in the life insurance industry for over 50 years and has done over 3,000 of these transactions over the years. Now, when you contact life insurance buyers, you will work with Greg or Lisa, never a third party. Life insurance buyers are licensed in all states that require a settlement license, and more importantly, they only work with providers and buyers who are licensed as well, which means life insurance buyers adheres to all of the state regulations set forth by the insurance industry in every state. Now, in determining whether a settlement is a good option for you, it is important to understand the difference between a settlement broker versus a settlement provider. A broker represents you, the policyholder, and their fiduciary responsibility is to you to present your policy to all licensed buyers and obtain the highest offer possible for you. A settlement provider represents the buyer of the policy, and their goal is to purchase the policy for a minimal price which does not benefit you, the seller of your policy. Life insurance buyers can broker virtually any type of life insurance policy, including group, term, if convertible, whole, and universal life. Not every policy can be sold. The type and amount of the policy, your age, your health, among other factors that life settlement companies consider. Life insurance buyers does not charge for their services to you. Their fee is paid by the buyer upon close of the transaction. No application fee, invasive interviews, or physical examinations are required, only that you complete a confidential information inquiry. For more detailed information, please contact Greg or Lisa at 1-800-936-5508. All contact information will be listed in the podcast notes.
Definition of grave disability. And then other states followed suit. Now, other states have expounded on that definition. Colorado, North Carolina, Utah, like there's other states out there that have, really, really expanded definitions of grave disability. It wasn't until last year, so more than 50 years later, was the definition of grave disability amended, so to speak. So last year, it has been amended to include food, clothing, shelter, or safety, or medical conditions. So if you're not able to care for yourself in a way that you keep putting yourself in harm's way, we're going to consider you gravely disabled and that we need to take care of you and you're not able to take care of yourself. So that's, or if you're not taking care of your severe medical condition, same thing. So those are the two things that were added. What the impact was is that the pendulum really swung to the other side, where it was very difficult. It has become, and it continues to be, very difficult to hospitalize someone who clearly qualifies. So they meet the qualifications of grave disability and or harm to themselves. But because there are so few resources available, meaning there's nowhere to put them,
yeah,
what psychiatrists and hospital administrators have had to do is basically increase their own, the bar of their own definition of grave disability. It's like, well, yeah, but, you know, they get food out of the trash can, so that's okay. Well, they've got a tent, so that's okay. And it's like, you know, it's like, it really, really is difficult. Really is difficult. You really have to make a big deal to get someone hospitalized
It
against
sounds
their.
that way. Yeah.
And then, and again, and then there are some people who they, even if you do start them on medications and deal with their delusions and their hallucinations, they're still debilitated. So with, we'll use schizophrenia as an example. With schizophrenia, it is a brain disease. And like most diseases, if it goes untreated, it gets worse over time and is more difficult to treat over time. So for someone who has been schizophrenic for 30 years and they get help, now they might not be hearing voices anymore, but they're still not able to make executive decisions. And so there's, they might not need to be in a quote unquote locked facility, but they might need a type of care where they can't quite live by themselves, but they can live like in a type of residential facility where there's people 24/7 to help take care of them. So those are very far and few between. And so my group, I also founded a group called the Grave Disability Work Group, been going strong for about 7 years now. And what we talk about is housing that heals. So it's for people who may have, you know, gotten past that point of where they've, you know, they're no longer psychotic. They're no longer thinking that, you know, Jesus is telling them to go into their neighbor's home and, you know, defecate in the kitchen. You know, it's like, you know, something like that is a very common scenario. It gets them in jail. And so what we're saying is like, let's treat them and then put them in a place, a residential place. Doesn't have to be locked, but it can be locked. Locked facilities can still be a nurturing place for people to live. I have a friend who works for an organization called Synergy, where she has these type of residential facilities. Most of the people in these facilities are conserved, which means that a judge decided that this person could not take care of themselves and that someone else needed to make decisions for them. So about two-thirds of her population are conserved, but they're still allowed to, you know, walk to the store and go to the park, and it's a very nurturing environment. But when you go to that place and you hang out with those people, it's very similar to going to a home for people with developmental disabilities. Like, it felt exactly the same because these people have had years and years of this brain disease eating away at them to a point where they've become developmentally or acquired disabled. You know, they
now,
acquire a disability.
Now, the LPS Act, to be honest, apparently we're not really adhering to it. We're making exceptions, but if you took it by the letter of the law, you would probably wouldn't have anybody on the street, right?
If you took it to the letter of the law, people who could not provide and maintain housing for themselves would be considered gravely disabled.
Right.
And they would be hospitalized, and then they could get medically stable.
Yeah.
And then maybe to go to a step down situation to
right.
where it's not as locked, so to speak.
Yeah.
And They eventually get stepped down, but maintain their stability to a place that it, serves their needs. Everyone kind of falls, everyone's on a different spectrum. So some people might bounce back and be quote unquote normal. Those are going to be the younger folk, right? Who haven't had these long enough. And they actually, I mean, there's a woman in our group who has his who has a diagnosis of bipolar, to where she explains that she had to be hospitalized against her will, and it's she says it saved her life. And she thought that she had to jump in some river naked in order to have world peace, kind of a thing. And that she truly believed that, and so she was a danger to herself. And now she lives independently. She has a cat. She has a job. She's because she was able to be stabilized, she was a higher functioning person. So everyone's kind of at a different level of the spectrum of their ability to take care of themselves. And so we need places that are able to meet the needs of all those different levels. And so if you look at people, and because I mentioned it, I'll use people with developmental disabilities or intellectual disabilities. The state of California actually has a law that provides for their care for the rest of their life. And so my roommate has a son who is high functioning, developmentally delayed person, and he was at a group home for a little bit, and the state was paying $9,000 a month for this group home, whereas people with severe mental illness, the state doesn't pay for them. And so there's really nowhere for them to go. The only place they can go are, say, boarding cares that are willing to take their SSI check. That's about $1,000 a month. And so you see the disparity. And a lot of boarding cares can't afford to keep the lights on because they're getting literally one tenth of what it to take this population.
So
And so
I think it's mostly a lack of resources is what you alluded to.
it's a lack of resources, but the lack of resources can be remedied. So it's a lack of will to really take care. I mean, there should be absolutely no difference between taking care of someone who's developmentally disabled and someone who is schizophrenic and unable to take care of themselves. Why does one get a home and the state pays $9,000 a month for them, and one gets the streets or jails or die? There is something more to than just not of resources. There's something about not wanting to take care of the severely mentally ill.
It's a mindset. It's a mindset issue.
Like when we think of someone with dementia wandering the streets, we're like, oh my God, of course we have to hospitalize them. But when we think of someone with severe mental illness wandering the streets, we're like, that's just the way it is. So that's your own kid. Do you have kids, Ron? Yeah. If that was your own kid, you would do anything to make sure that that kid wasn't in the streets, in, eating out of the garbage and
Absolutely.
death. So yeah, it's really sad when you see it, up front. And that's why I started what I to do, because I was just like, this is ridiculous.
Well, we have to move on. So the next question is, I want to briefly explain to us the concept of harm reduction and how policies in place, like at the shelters, et cetera, work against that concept and the effect on the patient.
So harm reduction means that we're doing whatever it takes to reduce as much harm as possible according to the client's desire. So I spoke earlier about there are some people, for instance, who aren't ready and do not want to stop using their substance, their drug of choice, right? So are we going to say, well, screw you, don't come back? No, we're going to keep, I'm going to still give them their flu vaccine. I'm still going to address their mental health needs if they want it. I'm still going to, address their wounds if they have wounds. I'm still going to try to get them housing. And now it does make it more difficult to house people in an interim, in a transitional living situation when they're using. And it, I mean, there's, it's a, it's a, it's a two, it's a, what's it called? Two-edged sword, two,
Yeah.
it's,
Two-edged sword. Yeah.
the double-edged sword,
Double
that's it.
edge. Yeah.
Sorry, because you want to be giving them a safe place, but then also is their behavior because of their substance use making it more difficult for the other people living there? So it's definitely, it's not cut and dry, but if you can allow people to be using their substances, I think it would allow for people to be housed. And I think they're starting to go in this direction already. I
Yeah,
mean,
that's
10 years ago, absolutely not. There's definitely some agencies are more harm reduction than others. And so you we are hearing more and more about, they can, like, for example, at the tiny homes in the valley, they all have lockers on outside. So if they want to go outside to their locker, go to the park and use, and then come back and then go into the little village, so they're trying to work with people as much as they can. But really, I'm gonna give you some examples that will really freak people out. But I had a patient, I still work with him, and he was in a housing situation where they found some paraphernalia on.
Let's break away for a moment to let me tell you about a book our podcast supporter, Rissa August, has written titled The Road Unpaved, Border to Border with a Brain Tumor and a Bite, which gives the reader an honest, intimate look at a Herculean physical effort while revealing a very personal struggle with a brutal disease. Read and write along with Rissa as she relates her incredible experiences with acromegaly, a rare condition where the body produces too much growth hormone, causing body tissues and bones to grow more quickly, leading to a wide range of devastating and damaging symptoms. Follow her successful, inspiring challenge to cycle the Pacific Coast Highway from north to south, which is 1,845 miles long from Canada to Mexico. The old Rissa could have done the ride in her sleep, but for the new Rissa, trapped in a body that no longer feels like her own, and stuck in the company of her brain tumor named Bubba, the ride becomes a challenge unlike she has ever had to face. The book is a testament to the power of the human spirit. Rissa shares her honest account of being diagnosed with a brain tumor and how she found meaning, purpose, and joy in uncertainty. Filled with passion and exuding deep insight, Rissa takes the reader on an adventure of the soul. You will be captivated as Rissa goes against all odds and digs deep within herself. The reader also pedals along on a profound journey of adversity. Rissa masterfully weaves together both humor and brutal honesty to provide a window into the patient experiencing of one suffering from a significant medical condition. It is a heart-wrenching yet refreshing account of finding the courage to break down barriers and to embrace and live one's best life. As Rissa pedals through rain, pain, and the ghosts of her memories, she wonders if the woman she once was will ever return or whether the new woman rising up in her place just might be the person she was meant to be all along. Every once in a while, a person and a book comes across your path that makes you stop and realize just how precious life is, and that we should seize every single opportunity and make the most of every moment we have been given. Rissa is one such person, and her incredible, uplifting, and inspiring story will leave a lasting imprint on your heart and mind. In this wonderful book, I have no doubt that you will vow every day to be more like Rissa in your outlook and actions. The book is available in paperback, audio, Audible, and Kindle format from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Rakuten, Bookshop, and Goodreads. Rissa's website, www.rissaaugust.com, lists all your purchasing options and dates of book signings. The book information will be listed in the podcast notes.
So some paraphernalia, and they said, in order for you to maintain your housing situation, you need to go to rehab. So that's not very harm reduction oriented. I'll say that from the get-go. But he was also on psychiatric medication that I was giving him. So he had the wherewithal to say, I really like not being in the streets. Let me go to, I'll go to this rehab. I'll do what I have to do. So he made a good decision. But when he was still seeing me for his mental health issues while he was in rehab, he was saying, don't tell them, but I, in my head, I still want to use. And I'm still considering using when I'm done with this 3-month rehab. And so instead of me going, oh, are you sure? Come on, you know, why would you want to keep using? I said, okay, I got it. So let's figure out how you can use and not overdose and not die. So we kind of go back to that first, you know, mantra of don't die. So because I said that, he felt comfortable in telling me how he was feeling. So every couple of weeks I would see him, and so we started coming up with a plan with medication where he can still get high, because that was his choice, and my point was, and not die, right?
Right.
So then he comes and sees me a couple of days after he finishes his 90 days, right? And I'm like freaking out, because I'm like, did you use? We haven't put our thing into, you know, our plan into motion. He's like, I haven't used and I don't want to. So he came to that decision on his own, but knowing that I was going to be there for him no matter what. Yeah. So whatever decision he made, I just wanted to make sure he was safe and healthy. And I just saw him last week. He's been clean for 9 months.
Wow, that's great. So you're definitely making progress with that philosophy.
Yeah, so that's an example of harm reduction to three. And then it comes back to, you know, really work in his favor and my favor, because I want the best for him.
Now I want to go over some 2020 statistics for the audience. There's over 66,000 people in Los Angeles County are unhoused. Two-thirds live on the streets because there is not enough shelter beds. There's thousands of children on the street. 74% of the unhoused are disabled. 33% suffer from mental health problems. 50% are depressed, and 35% have physical disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
42% have an addiction problem. The average age of life expectancy is 47 years old. So being on the streets is their rock bottom. So what policy changes from government and institutions dealing with people experiencing homelessness are you hoping for?
So for me, of that group, the sickest of the sick are going to be the gravely disabled, right? So they are gravely disabled, either from being severely mentally ill and or substance use. Now, if someone is physically disabled, they have really rallied around, especially LA County has created a program called Housing for Health, where they started off looking at people who were frequent flyers in the county system, like using the emergency rooms over and over and over again. And they decided, maybe we should house these people. It might be less expensive.
Yeah.
And it's the right thing to do, right?
Right.
So So that's been proven that housing people, and this, and we've definitely gone into this, followed this path where, the housing first path. So most people realize, okay, before I can cure this person's substance use, or before I can, really deal with their diabetes, I gotta house them.
Right.
But so this is where I come in. The people who aren't touched by that are those who are severely mentally ill, gravely disabled, and they don't want to be housed. They don't want to accept resources because of their delusions and or because of their substance use. And so those are the people that I think we need to be most aggressive with. And so there has been laws in California. Care Court was passed, or the Care Act was passed in 2022. And that's trying to address people who are severely mentally ill by the state giving counties more resources to deal with this population and to get them the care that they need through this Care Court program. So that's one way. So basically, innovative ways of housing and treating people who are severely mentally ill or gravely disabled. So what that means is a lot of times we're going to have to start treatment first, housing second. So a small percentage of people, housing first doesn't work. So this small percentage of people who I'm saying is the sickest of the sick,
Yeah.
we need to do treatment first. So treatment first means starting them on antipsychotics in the street, starting them on the long-acting injectables in the street, starting them on their buprenorphine, which is the opiate replacement medicine for if they want to get off opiates. And there's medication for meth use as well. So starting all that on the streets is now for the sickest of the sick is the way to go. And so if we can develop more programs, so that's what I'm doing right now, is I'm developing a program that we're calling the Low Barrier Bridge Psychiatry Program. So low barrier meaning you don't have to go to a clinic, you don't have to get an appointment. It's like if someone says, hey, I have Joe Schmo here and he's out of his antipsychotic, I can talk to him on the phone, I can order it from a pharmacy, I can have either the outreach person take him to that pharmacy to get an injection, or they can pick up the meds and bring it to him. So we're really trying to get people treated as fast as possible, because we've noticed that once they start getting their mental health treated with antipsychotics, they're ready to accept resources, and then they can go into housing, and then they can start living their life.
That's excellent. That's excellent. What is the toll of practicing street medicine had on you and your colleagues? I mean, it's got to be, I'm sure, nerve-wracking at times when you want to help somebody and they refuse it, or give you a problem for a long time, and maybe down the road they accept it. But what is the toll on you guys? What's it been?
A very mercurial emotional state. So your highs are high and your lows are your lows. Your lows are low. So your lows are someone dies after you've been working with them for months or years.
Yeah.
And your highs are someone got housed, or someone got off their substances, or they're spending time with their family. So it's almost like a little bit of an addiction in itself. Because when something works out right, it's the best feeling in the whole wide world. And so it's usually like, the whole few steps forward, some steps back, few steps more forward, few steps back. So it is really hard. I mean, there was one point where I was going out on the streets 3 times a week, and that was too much for me. There's some people who go out every day on to the streets, and so it's yeah, I mean, we just have to be very Like we have an outreach team at Homeless Healthcare, and I meet with them once a month. I'm checking in with them. How are you guys doing? What are your challenges? What are your celebrations? Both in work and personal. And the woman who's the director for the outreach team, I mean, she's just really good at making sure that people are taken care of, and they meet really regularly, checking in with each other. If they need time off, you give them time off. And so it's a very supportive group, and you really have to build that in. It's like anything. It's like, when you're working in an emergency room or a psychiatric hospital, or probably law enforcement have similar
Yeah.
issues. A lot of frustrations, a lot of hoops, but when something does go right, it's extremely rewarding.
Well, I would imagine a tough part would be you're seeing these people over and over again, and you're developing a relationship. And if it does go south, I can imagine it's probably like losing a friend, you know? Yeah, it's got to be tough. Tell us about your work in Haiti. You have a nonprofit, it's HEAL, which stands for Health Empowerment, Advocacy, and Learning. And will you continue your work there in lieu of a US State Department warning to avoid traveling there?
Now, I haven't been there since 2021. I haven't taken medical students since 2019. We were planning on going in 2020. We were going to go in May of 2020, and then of course COVID hit, and so we couldn't go. And then since then, it's just so sad. It's just so freaking sad. It's being run by gang members, basically. The country is being run by gang members who assassinated their president. It was in 2021 that the president was assassinated. They really haven't come back from that. And there's kidnappings happening. So it's really not safe. It's not even safe for me to go, never mind bringing medical students. So what we are doing is we still fundraise. We support. There's a local doctor that goes to the area that we used to go to regularly. He is there twice a week, and so we send him money. And we're very close, and I know, I can trust him as much as I can trust him. But and they're working with there's a nursing school in that area, and so he's working with them. And so we're still, on the outskirts, at least financially supporting the medical care. And so until it's a little bit safer, yeah, it's a really hard one, because it really breaks my heart in so many levels. I mean, it was such a great program bringing medical students there. I think it really just really was a game changer for a lot of people in their careers, a lot of students in their careers, because we took them as third year medical students, not fourth years. So that was like when they're just starting to figure out what they want to
Yeah.
be, in their career. And I still keep in touch with our sister organization's CEO, and so we're still, we still have our finger on the pulse of what's going on there, and just waiting for her to kind of say, okay, now you can come.
Okay.
So,
So we're waiting till it gets stabilized, I would say.
so yeah, we're kind of on hold with that, but in the meantime, I do. My next book is actually is on Haiti. It's kind of in the same style, where it's short stories. Each year that I went, I actually did a blog, and so it's a compilation of
Yeah,
my.
I did read that blog. I'm on your blog, I believe. Yeah,
And so,
it's interesting.
like blogs, and especially when I went before the earthquake, It was really, I have a little bit of PTSD to be honest with you, because we were working at a clinic right next to a malnutrition center, and we were having kids dying every day, and that was really, really hard for me. A, I'm not a pediatrician. B, I'm not an emergency medicine doctor. And B, we're in Haiti. There's no there's nothing, no lab capabilities whatsoever. And so it was really, really, really difficult to that situation. So I write about that, and I write every year that we went up until 2019. So hopefully that'll be also be a good read. But for now, Renegade MD is where you're where
And
you're
you answered one of my questions, like, are you planning on writing any new books? Now tell us about your new book, Renegade MD. And what you would like the readers to take away from reading it, and where it can be purchased.
So it can be purchased on Amazon.com or BookBaby.com. And if you do read it and you like it, go ahead and leave a review. I would love for this to become a TV series. I'll just put it out there. I'll just put do the pie in the sky kind of thing.
Let's hope it
And
sticks to the wall.
right. And the reason is it's I compare it to Call the Midwife, where it's a very specific situation and with kind of a lot of harrowing and dynamics. But really what I wanted people to see was that I tell stories about people that I was encountering, and I want people to see the humanity that I see in them. And so when I'm talking to someone, I might be joking with them. I might be singing Bye Bye Miss American Pie with them. I might be, talking about arts and crafts. I mean, whatever. Like, I treat them like a normal person. And so I want people to see that spark of humanity in each person that I see. And it's not that people don't care about people, but I think if they really see that this person could have been my sister, this person could have been me, this person could have been my mother, that I think that's how we get closer to being a we society and not a them society. And just really, and I get there is, I'm going to acknowledge that there is some compassion fatigue out there, right? There's a lot of people out there that are hurting. There's a lot of poor people out there. There's a lot of impoverished people. There's a lot of, whatever. So I get it. And I'm not saying that you have to care. I don't want, I'm not saying that everyone has to go out and, do what I do, but find something that you are passionate about to see the humanity that I see in everyone that I come across. Even if they're like a, I even tell a story of this cantankerous older woman who's basically flipping me off, but at the same time I'm like, that could be my grandma,
Yeah. And I always tell people, you see somebody out there, they could be begging for money, they could be sitting on a park bench, homeless or whatever. They have a story. There's a reason that why they're there. You don't know what the reason is, so I don't make judgments. I don't make judgments on people is what I always say. You just don't know what their situation is or was or what they're doing. So that's important. Dr. Partovi, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, your organization or whatever, what's the best contact information?
So I have, if they want to learn more about what we're doing with HEAL, that's weareheal.org.
We are HEAL, HEAL.org. I'm going to put
That's,
this in the podcast notes, so don't worry about that.
and then, or they can go to my website, which is therenegademd.com.
The Renegade MD.com. And that would, could they get the book there too? Oh, great. All right. Do you autograph the book as well?
I have a book launch in Venice on February 4th, which
Okay.
is
February 4th in Venice for all the people listening to the podcast in Southern California. Okay.
I know. If they go to my website, they can see the event and they can RSVP to the event. And then I will, they can buy a book through that. And then I will sign it for them at the event.
Okay, sounds good. I want to thank you for being on the podcast. I want to thank you for shining a spotlight on the homeless subject and educating us on it. You're truly one of a kind, and all you have done to help the homeless and those in need of medical attention. I want to wish you the very best in the future in your future endeavors, and the podcast will always be a voice for the voiceless, and we stand with you in your efforts to help the downtrodden in this world. So I want to
Thanks.
thank you. It's just been a pleasure to talk to you. And I think everybody out there listening is really appreciating what you do.
Thanks so much. Thanks for offering to host me and give a
Anytime. And when that new book comes out, feel free. We'll put you
I'll
back on. And can't wait to read that one.
No.
People out there who have comments and suggestions for the podcast, you can email me at itsawrapwithrap at gmail.com. Our website is itsawrapwithrap.com. We are on Facebook. We have a Facebook group, It's a Wrap with Rap. We have a couple thousand people on there. Instagram, It's a Wrap with Rap podcast. We're on Twitter or X at Rapper, WRAPPER 130. We have a YouTube channel. So everything, all the episodes are on YouTube. You can watch it. It's a Wrap with Wrap, the podcast uncut. I want to thank everybody for listening, and everybody, please stay safe. And for now, it's a wrap. This podcast is being brought to you in part by the veteran-founded Hero Soap Company, located in Phoenix, Arizona. In today's environment, we must be aware of the products we apply to our skin. As a two-time cancer survivor, I cannot afford to take chances, and I use these products myself. The soaps will leave you feeling clean and refreshed. All the products made by the Hero Soap Company are made in the United States with the highest quality ingredients sourced from companies in the United States whenever possible. The products are made in small batches to ensure high quality and contain premium essential oils and fragrance. All Hero soaps are created without synthetic colorants, parabens, and sulfates that are irritating to the eyes, skin, mouth, and lungs, and are cruelty-free, meaning these products are not tested on animals. Each 5-ounce bar of soap is handmade in Phoenix, Arizona, and the body wash is available in 8 ounces with such refreshing scents as the woods, tea tree, lavender, the fields, bourbon, lime, the pines, and Arctic. You will absolutely love this soap. Please also check out their gear for sale. All the products are reasonably priced. Being veteran-founded, the company understands the dedication and sacrifice that each family makes to serve their country. A portion of sales is donated back to charities that are focused on helping veterans and our first responders. Over 1,200 bars have been sent to our deployed troops. Please check out their website, HeroSoapCompany.com, for pricing and a detailed description of all the products. When ordering, use the code RAP for a 10% discount. The company information will be listed in the podcast notes and featured on the podcast website, Facebook group page, and the podcast Instagram.